Good evening. Welcome and thank you all for being here tonight. Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Safwan Masri, Executive Vice President for Global Centers and Global Development at Columbia University. I'm greatly honored to have been asked to offer a couple of thoughts on this very special and poignant occasion. This fall marks the 11th year anniversary since Edward's passing in 2003. To honor his legacy and to ensure that it continues in the intellectually vibrant and passionately engaged manner that was his defining trait, Columbia University initiated the Edward Said Memorial Lecture. Over the past 10 years, this series has featured talks by some of the most distinguished authors, philosophers, linguists, historians, activists, intellectuals, musicians, and poets, many of whom were among Edward's closest friends and colleagues. They've included Noam Chomsky, Adonis, Ahdaf Zuwaif, and Daniel Barenboim, among others. I'll also mention Mahmoud Darwish, who was going to deliver one of these lectures, but sadly passed away right before. It is only befitting that the future of this lecture series be as illustrious as its past, and continue to celebrate the memory of the great man whose name it bears, and whose home Columbia was for over four decades. We are thus deeply grateful that we have wonderful supporters who have made generous commitments that will now allow us to endow the series in perpetuity. I would like to take this opportunity to recognize and thank our staunchest supporters. The Abraj Group, and in particular its chief executive and my dear friend, Arif Naqvi, Talal Shair, the Asfari family, and Dorothy Gallagher. I would like to also single out Jean Stein, whose generous initial gift made this lecture series possible. We cannot but be very proud that Columbia has been an academic home to a unique concentration of notable scholars of Palestine, including Rashid Khaldi and a number of other colleagues such as Leila Abu Lughad, Brinkley Messick, Nadia Abu Hajj, and Mahmoud Mamdani, to name but a few. We're also proud that a few years ago, the Center for Palestine Studies was founded here at Columbia, the first and perhaps still only such center to be located in an academic institution anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, whose singular mission is to promote the academic study of Palestine and to continue the legacy of Edward Said. There's nothing one can say that could truly capture the essence of Edward and what he meant to each and every one of us, from husband and father, mentor and teacher, colleague and trusted friend. So much has already been said about Edward, his passionate commitment to and tireless work on behalf of the Palestinian cause, his outstanding scholarship that spanned comparative literature, literary theory, and post-colonialism, his contributions to humanity. So much has been said about him that one is at a loss. Apropos, I would like to share a few words about my own personal history with Edward. In March of 1988, as I was considering faculty offers from a number of universities, including Columbia, I needed advice and decided to call on Edward Said. I remember that late March afternoon vividly. As I sat in my room at the Warwick Hotel on 54th Street and 6th Avenue, I called Edward for the first time. He was in his office, and after spending an hour with me on the line, I felt overwhelmed by his generosity and sensitive and caring nature. Indeed, one of the major draws to Columbia for me was Edward Said. We met for the first time over dinner at a mutual friend's house in New York. At the end of that evening, I gave Edward and Mariam a ride home. I think Najla and Wadia were probably running around in their shorts. This marked the beginning of a friendship punctuated with gatherings, events, concerts, and conversations over meals. I got to know his wife Mariam and his children Wadia and Najla. The last time I saw Edward was shortly before he passed. I invited him for lunch at Columbia's faculty house. When I asked him how he was doing, he replied, "To the dismay of my enemies, I am still alive." Indeed, 11 years after his passing, his enemies must still be quite dismayed, because Edward's presence today in academic discourse and on the very subject of Palestine is no less imposing than it was during his feistiest days. Needless to say, his influence at Columbia, perhaps best captured by the Edward Said Chaired Professorship, remains pervasive and acute. Our next speaker has the honor of being the first academic to hold the Said Professorship title and chair, and for whom Edward's advice weighed heavily on his own decision to move here from the University of Chicago. He really needs no introduction, but I hope you'll indulge me as I highlight a few of the many accomplishments of Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Rashid is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies and was president of the Middle East Studies Association. He was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations in the early 1990s, which he shares experiences from in his most recent book, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Rashid is also the author of Sowing Crisis, American Dominance and the Cold War in the Middle East, The Iron Cage, the Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood, Palestinian Identity, the Construction of Modern National Consciousness, which won the Albert Hourani Prize of the Middle Eastern Studies Association, as well as a number of other influential books and hundreds of scholarly articles. Truly, there could not be a more apt torchbearer. With that, please join me in welcoming to the podium Rashid Khalidi, who will introduce this year's Edward Said Memorial Lecturer, Professor Richard Falk. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you for that over-generous introduction, Safwan. Since Safwan shared an Edward story, let me share an Edward story. I have the misfortune to currently be the chair of the Department of History. It's a distinguished department. I'm very proud to have that job, but it's a misfortune because you are basically the mother and father official, as the Chinese expression would have it, to 60 of your colleagues. And you learn about the difficulties of bargaining with them over salary and so on and so forth. And I am benefiting now, as I benefited in the past, from the advice of the only person I really learned from in these things, who is Edward. He mentored me in how you deal with universities in matters of negotiation. And now that I'm dealing with negotiations from the other side on behalf of the university, I doubly appreciate his mentorship. But it is true, as Safwan said, that I came here at the urging of Edward. Now, this urging would usually come around 6:30 or 7 in the morning in the form of a phone call asking, why haven't you accepted yet? Is this not good enough for you, the Edward Said Professorship? And I finally had to say to him, he started mainly with phone calls to my wife at 6:30, and then he would call me at 7 or 7:30 and continue. Finally, I had to say to him, I'm just doing what you told me. And he said, what do you mean doing what I told you? And I said, well, you told me that the only time that anyone has any bargaining power in dealing with these powerful institutions is before you accept. The moment I say yes, I become chopped liver, and they take me for granted, which I've learned is actually true. So it was thanks to him that I came here. It was an offer I could not refuse. It was an honor and a distinction that I still feel I have to live up to. And it's an enormous pleasure to introduce this year's speaker in the annual Edward Said Memorial Lecture Series. Richard Falk is obviously someone who needs no introduction, or there wouldn't be a line of people outside on Amsterdam waiting to get into this talk. He's someone who has shown, as I'm going to try and show you in the rest of my introduction, absolutely extraordinary scholarship. And I'll mention just a few of his enormously distinguished works. But he's also someone who has used that scholarship in ways to try and change the world. And that required enormous courage. It required a willingness to stand up to a level of vilification, which actually Edward knew and encountered, which I've tasted a tiny bit of, but which I think that Richard has really endured with enormous stoicism and bravery. I'm going to read a little bit of his biography. And I think you'll see that in his interventions in the world, he has brought to bear not just humanism, not just a sympathetic understanding for the lives of people, but extraordinarily distinguished legal scholarship. This is a man who has really written the book on various aspects of international law. He truly knows whereof he speaks. Richard Falk is the Albert G. Miliband Professor of International Law and Practice Emeritus at Princeton. He was a member of the faculty of that distinguished institution for 40 years. Since 2002, he's been visiting distinguished professor in global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His bravery came during the six-year term that he served, starting in 2008, as Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine for the UN Human Rights Council. He also served on a panel of experts appointed by the President of the UN General Assembly from 2008 to 2009. You can only imagine how, starting in 2008, the year in which Operation Cast Lead began, the attack on Gaza from the December of 2008 through January of 2009, and continuing for 6 years through a little more than a year ago, what kind of circumstances Richard Falk found himself in. He was obliged by his training, by his humanity, by his knowledge of the law to call a spade a spade. And he did so with forthrightness, with honesty, and received a deluge of vituperation that no human being should have to endure. And I want you to think of this as you listen to him this evening. This is the voice not only of learning and knowledge of the law and of various other things. I'm going to read a few of the titles so you see precisely what I'm talking about. But someone who has spent 6 years trying to apply these principles in the most difficult of circumstances. In the past 50 years, a little under 50 years, Richard Falk has written and edited over 25 books. That's a book every 2 years. But four of them are multi-volume works. Four volumes, five volumes. In fact, if you count it in volumes, it's a book every year and a bit. These include, and I'm just going to read some of the titles, The Role of Domestic Courts in the International Legal Order, The Strategy of World Order, Legal Order in a Violent World. Think of these titles when you think of what he was doing as a UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. The Status of Law in International Society, The Vietnam War and International Law. That was a four-volume work. The Future of the International Legal Order. That was a four-volume edited work. Law in an Emerging Global Village, a Post-Westphalian Perspective. Human Rights Horizons. The Record of the Paper. This is one of my favorites. The Record of the Paper, How the New York Times Misreports Foreign Policy. International Law and World Order. This is a book that's now in its fourth edition. It's used as a textbook all over the country, all over the world. Crimes of War, Iraq. Israel-Palestine on the Record, How the New York Times Misreports Conflict in the Middle East. Obviously, you see a pattern here. The Costs of War, International Law, the UN and World Order After Iraq. Human Rights, Critical Concepts in Political Science, five volumes. And Achieving Human Rights. This is just a selection of the 25 works that Richard Falk has either written or edited. And what we have here is someone who has actually taken and distilled the kind of knowledge and learning which most of the time is cooped up in the academy and actually applied it to the real world. He has found that his training, his background, his knowledge are things that actually are needed in the world. And he's gone out in spite of extraordinary pressure on him not to do so, and, as I said before, called a spade a spade. This is a man who is a very distinguished successor to some very distinguished speakers in this series. So I ask you to join me in welcoming Richard Falk.
I should be quite angry at Rashid for introducing me in a way that I'm sure I can't live up to, but I'll forgive him. I want to say, first of all, good evening to friends and colleagues and distinguished visitors here. I want to particularly acknowledge and send greetings to Edward Said's grandson, and to my granddaughter, Juliet, who are gluttons for punishment. But I'm happy that they're here. I'm honored, saddened, and intimidated by the occasion of this lecture. Honored to join with the others who in preceding years have spoken so perceptively about the rich legacy left by Edward Said. Saddened because I am reminded strongly of my lost, cherished friendship with Edward, and what a cultural and political loss his death remains for many of us after more than 11 years. Although there are many eloquent, courageous, inspiring, and culturally creative Palestinians, none has managed to extend their influence as widely and deeply as Edward did, particularly during the post-Orientalism phase of his life, when he combined superb and seminal cultural criticism from a progressive standpoint with exceedingly perceptive and influential commentary on the ups and downs of the Palestinian national struggle. Finally, I feel intimidated to be speaking here at Columbia, where Edward was such a strong presence for decades and continues to live on in the active memory of his family, his many friends, colleagues, and former students. It may sound pretentious for me to admit that the situation here reminds me of a remark made by T.S. Eliot before a public reading of his poems. He said, "I'm reluctant to say anything about my poems because there are always so many people in the audience who know more about them than I do." I have a similar predicament, as I know many here have a much more expert and sensitive knowledge of Edward's work than I do. My main attempt this evening will be to reflect upon Edward's fascinating essay entitled Lost Causes that combines intriguing literary assessments with his complex understanding of the Palestinian ordeal and destiny. This essay was one of his last major interpretive contributions, and according to his friend and associate Andrew Rubin, was regarded by Edward as the publication that satisfied him most in the final period of his life. Part of my interest in this theme of lost causes derives from a rather tense encounter I had with the French ambassador to the UN at a private dinner in New York City at the end of my term as UN Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine. Our host had invited a dozen or so diplomats who sat around the table to comment upon the Israel-Palestine conflict as they waited for the main course to be served, and I was expected to respond to each of them. This typically overconfident and somewhat belligerent French diplomat started the ball rolling with some very provocative statements. He said, "Let's face it, the conflict is over. Israel has won, the Palestinians have been defeated, there is nothing more to be done or said. I'm not happy about this, but this is the reality. We should move on." In effect, in the spirit of cynical realism, He was declaring that the Palestinian struggle was indeed over. In a way, my choice of focus tonight can be seen as a more considered response to this French ambassador that evening, as an insistence on my part that the Palestinian struggle is not a lost cause in his sense, and even if it were a lost cause from the perspective of realism, a continued commitment to the Palestinian struggle is greatly to be preferred to some kind of defeatist resignation and indifference toward such a grossly unjust outcome of such an epic struggle. My deeper conviction is that the appearance of Palestinian defeat is an optical illusion that hides the deeper reality of a probable impending Israeli defeat, that while Israel is winning one war due to its military dominance and continuous establishment of facts on the ground, Palestine is winning what in the end is the more important war, the legitimacy struggle that is most likely to determine the political outcome. If the outcome of international conflicts during the last 50 years is carefully considered, it reveals the astonishing conclusion that the weaker side militarily controlled the political outcome almost all the time in struggles against foreign rule and occupation. It turns out that in recent history, it is on the side with the greatest perseverance and resilience, not the side that controls the battlefield, that wins in the end. This is a profound and very new reality that was not true at all during the era of European colonialism, and not generally until 1945 at the end of World War II. The failures of foreign interventions and occupations should have been the lesson that the US government learned in Vietnam, but failed to do so. It remains the great unlearned and anti-realist lesson. Military superiority in this period, unlike in earlier periods, has lost most of its historical agency in politically and ethically oriented conflicts against foreign, especially Western, domination, although military superiority continues to shape the course of battlefield outcomes. And this is the new reality, but not of wars. It was a lesson already captured by the extraordinary ending of Pontecorvo's 1966 film, The Battle of Algiers, in which the defeated Algerian movement of national liberation miraculously achieved its victory over French colonialism. As George W. Bush discovered in Iraq, it is possible for the Western intervener to win easily the first type of war and yet go on to lose the vital legitimacy struggle that follows. In the end, the political goals that prompted the military attack in the first place lose their claim to be a mission accomplished and become acknowledged many deaths later as a mission impossible. Some years ago, I lent emotional support to a Hawaiian native rights movement and came to know its inspirational leader, Kekuni Blaisdell. Blaisdell, from a leading Hawaiian family that was one of the first, had become one of the first medical doctors in Honolulu with a conscious native heritage. He succeeded professionally in the westernized world of modern Hawaii, more or less ignoring his own background or the degree to which traditional Hawaii was a casualty of American colonizing ambitions. In midlife, Kekuni awakened to his native past, learned the Hawaiian language and its songs, dedicating himself to the small but determined Hawaiian independence movement, and celebrated the memory of the last Hawaiian kingdom. Surely this was the adoption of a lost cause, a contradictory life choice to that of an opportunist who jumps on the bandwagon so as to be situated on what realists identify as the winning side. Yet Kekuni, in choosing to align with the lost cause of Hawaiian independence, became fulfilled in ways that far transcended his earlier professional success or the kind of life experience of Hawaiians who passively accepted the historical verdict of their defeat. Somehow, his luminous dedication generated love and devotion to this man that was quite unrelated to the awareness that his vision of a restored Hawaii seemed doomed, surely a lost cause if ever there was one. He was enacting in life what Don Quixote exemplified in literature. In a similar vein, Edward, in his essay on lost causes, refers to the Japanese veneration of noble defeat as a superior course of action in life. His prime literary example happens to be Don Quixote, whose absurd mission to revive the chivalric way of life in Spain was also doomed to failure, but who achieved notable personal success in the midst of mundane failing by embodying in his life a vision that was redemptive. In Edward's words, of course the Don is unsuccessful in restoring Amadis of Gaul and the age of chivalry, but the strength of his conviction is such as even to expose the sordid reality of this extremely unheroic world of ours, with its innkeepers, shepherds, itinerant rogues, to an idealism whose self-conviction and fervor look backwards to an age that has disappeared. This faith in the unrealizable achieves a fulfilling repudiation of what history has brought to pass, even if the glorified past cannot be tangibly reclaimed. Edward is careful to distinguish cultural tropes in the domain of literary imagination from the flesh and blood realism of political struggle. Near the beginning of the long essay, he identifies a lost cause as one, quoting him, associated in the mind and in practice with a hopeless cause, that is, something you support or believe in that can no longer be believed in except as something without hope of achievement. He goes on to say, the cause and belief has passed. The cause no longer seems to contain any validity or promise, although it may once have possessed both. At that point, he poses what he calls the crucial question, which is to decide whether such a judgment hinges on interpretation alone or is based on subjective circumstances. In this respect, the lostness of a lost cause is itself problematized. Edward himself refers to the example of pursuing Hawaiian independence, observing that what seems lost at the moment may become attainable at some future time when circumstances change beyond our powers of anticipation, which they constantly do in real life. Ironically, of course, this was the experience of the Zionist project, which would have almost certainly have remained a lost cause without the drastically changed circumstances brought about by the Holocaust. But there exists a contrary view that effectively denies the contingency of experience and places its trust in the reliability of appearances. The French diplomat expressed this attitude by being so sure that the Palestinians had been defeated once and for all. Edward describes and rejects such an outlook as that of a strict determinist about the survival only of powerful nations and peoples. In that case, as Edward points out, the cause of native rights in Hawaii or gypsies or aborigines is always necessarily a lost cause, something both predestined to lose out and because of belief in the overall narrative of power, required to lose. Before turning to the present phase of the Palestinian struggle, there is another general idea that relates closely to apparently lost causes that should lead to further reflections on lostness and failure. This additional line of thinking is suggested by the anti-realism of such seminal figures as Alain Badeau and Slavoj Zizek. In effect, they argue it is only lost causes that have the empowering potential to address the challenges confronting humanity. In this sense, abandoning the Enlightenment legacy of relying on the guidance of instrumental reason, Zizek proposes what he calls a leap of faith. In his words, what lies beyond involves a leap of faith, faith in lost causes, causes that from within the space of skeptical wisdom cannot but appear as crazy. It seems worth observing that at one stage, Theodor Herzl, the founder of the modern Zionist movement, declared, "You don't have to be crazy to be a Zionist, but it helps." That is, a burning faith in the unrealizable creates the possibility, however remote, that what seems beyond reach will at some point be reached. But why strike such a posture? Zizek's response, which I share and is very different from the focus craziness proposed by Herzl, is expressed as follows. In Zizek's words, the problem, of course, is that in a time of crisis and ruptures, skeptical empirical wisdom itself, constrained to the horizons of the dominant form of common sense, cannot provide the answers. And so one must risk a leap of faith. Put more simply, that the realm of the feasible, which is the theater of everyday politics, theorized as the art of the possible, cannot address the challenges confronting humanity or fragments of humanity as in circumstances of oppression, occupation, and servitude. From these perspectives, a dedication to what seems impossible from a realist perspective is in truth the only realism with emancipatory potential. It provides the only alternative to the sullen acceptance of the intolerable. In a global historical sense, this insight is most vividly appreciated by the inability of the powers that be to solve the challenges of nuclear weaponry and climate change that imperil the future of human civilization and even species survival, illustrating the impotence of reason in the face of such momentous challenges. In this regard, Zizek controversially examines prominent past failures, despite their hideous character in some instances, as what he calls wrong steps in the right direction, including Stalinism, Maoism, even revolutionary terror. He quotes approvingly the provocation of Samuel Beckett. After one fails, one can go on and fail better, which for Zizek contrasts with the prevailing posture of indifference toward the human condition that drowns us deeper in the morass of imbecilic being. The courage to embark on a utopian project of the sort associated with revolutionary movements, even with its experience of disillusionment and failure, contains what Zizek calls a redemptive moment, because it displays the willingness to struggle and even die on behalf of a better human future. And without such a willingness, we humans now seem doomed to become an extinct species in the not too distant future. To summarize up to this point, the embrace of lost causes is not what it seems to be, so long as we reject the cynical realism or skeptical wisdom of my French diplomat. In effect, since we never know what the future holds, and much that once seemed impossible has actually happened, no worthy cause is definitively lost. Related to this affirmation is the idea that dedication to a noble cause, whether viewed as lost or not, is itself individually and collectively redemptive. Further is the realization that the history of struggle for true freedom and justice, despite being obstructed by the brutal forces of reaction, needs to continue. Without such aspirations and struggle, the world and we in the world are lost. Goethe expressed this thought in the patriarchal language of his day, "Him who strives, he we may save." It is also the destiny of Sisyphus, consigned to push a heavy boulder forever up the side of a mountain, knowing that near the top it will fall back again to the bottom, and the process must be repeated endlessly. When Albert Camus informs us that we can imagine Sisyphus happy, that the best we can hope for in life is to strive and struggle for what is better, even while doing so, we have the awareness that failure is inevitable and hope irrelevant, that Sisyphus is living out a life sentence in pursuit of what is truly a lost cause. When Edward turns in the middle of his Tanner lecture from literature to his own existential connection with the theme of lost causes, his comments are worth reflecting upon. He asks two preliminary questions. What if we try to grapple with lost causes in the public political world, where effects on behalf of causes actually take place? Is there the same ironized inevitability there, or do subjective hope and renewed effort make a lost cause something to be refused as defeatism? Edward here poses in the abstract the crucial issue as to whether what is noble in literature becomes ethically unacceptable in the life world of political struggle. He personalizes this issue, saying, "Here I can do no better than to offer my personal experience as a politically active Palestinian, as evidence particularly as these have crystallized since the watershed Oslo Agreement of September 1993. It is worth pausing to note that 1993 was what I would call the second awakening of Edward Said in relation to the Palestinian national movement. The first awakening is well known, the impact of the 1967 war, moving Edward from an immersion in his professional role as prominent literary critic to adopt a new activist role as a leading public intellectual espousing the Palestinian cause. In other words, it was at the moment of what appeared to be the most humiliating political and military Palestinian defeat that Edward decides to devote mind and heart to the Palestinian struggle, thereby refusing the practical wisdom of the French diplomat earlier mentioned. Less well known is this 1993 turning point, when Edward's mounting skepticism about the directions of PLO leadership reached a negative climax in reaction to the Oslo events that most non-Palestinians at the times hailed as a breakthrough for peace. In my view, it was his judgment that Arafat and the PLO leadership, by agreeing to a diplomatic framework at Oslo that was slanted heavily toward Israel, had effectively surrendered and accepted an arrangement that amounted to a defeatist admission that the Palestinian struggle had indeed become a lost cause in the falsely definitive sense. Edward at that point resigned from the Palestinian National Council and pointedly refused to walk down this path of defeatism. More than 20 years later, the principled wisdom of his position is finally being widely acknowledged. I interpret the vote of a few days ago by the House of Commons in favor of recognizing Palestinian statehood as a belated and still somewhat ambiguous recognition of the futility of relying on the Oslo approach. Oslo insisted that only through negotiations could Palestine hope to move toward becoming a state, and by symbolically circumventing such a framework, the British Parliament was conveying the idea that it was unreasonable to deny Palestinian statehood any longer. As Omar Barghouti and others have pointed out, although the gesture was welcome, it means nothing if not reinforced by the recognition and realization of Palestinian rights, as including the right of self-determination. Edward, to explain his different phases of engagement with the Palestinian cause, contrasts the emergent nationalism that occurred after the 1967 experience with the defeatist diplomacy pursued up to and following from 1993. Indicting the PLO defeatism, Edward observes that it seemed neither appropriate nor really possible to see ourselves in terms of other dispossessed and forgotten peoples like the Armenians, American Indians, Tasmanians, Gypsies, and Australian Aborigines. Putting aside his controversial and, I believe, somewhat mistaken presumption that these defeated peoples are also forgotten, his Archimedean point of contrast is illuminating, and I quote him, "On the contrary, we modeled ourselves on the Vietnamese people, whose resistance to U.S. intervention seemed exactly what we should undertake." And it was coupled with his acknowledgement of inspiration that he received from the writing of Franz Fanon and the exploits of General Vo Nguyen Giap, the Vietnamese commanding general. It is crucial to understand that the "we" in Edward's phrasing was a reference to the Palestinian people of his persuasion and not to the leaders who represent Palestine on the global diplomatic stage. From the perspective of lost causes, Edward's choice of Fanon and Vietnam is illuminating. As already mentioned, the Vietnamese were somehow able to turn their totally lost cause on the battlefield, being completely dominated by American military superiority, into a miracle of political victory. This capacity of resilience and perseverance, what Palestinians call samud, on the part
of the peoples of the South during the struggles against Western colonial rule is a reality that the United States and Israel have yet to appreciate, as borne out by their sequence of failed interventions in the period since the 9/11 attacks, in the Arab world and Afghanistan, and now against ISIS. For Edwards' commitment to the Palestinian lost cause was globalized, and he said, "We saw ourselves as a third world people, subjected to colonialism and oppression, now undertaking our own self-liberation from domination as well as the liberation of our territory." In a later passage, he faults Palestinians for falling into the tactical and propaganda trap set by their adversaries of being perceived as terrorists, which he contends never was the true ethos of the movement. He insists that the Palestinian movement was and should remain secular and democratic in its essential ambition, and thus profoundly different from the politics elsewhere in the region, which he considers post-nationalist and oriented around some form of Islam. He believed that the Palestinian outlook was a distinct advance over those of the Arab states, with what he calls their oligarchies, military dictatorships, brutal police regimes. So the question he confronted was whether, as a Palestinian, he should accept a hopeful or defeatist view of what presented itself as a lost cause. And in opting for a hope against hope, he was challenging the lostness of the Palestinian lost cause, while the PLO, in opting for Oslo, was agreeing to swallow the bitter pill of defeat and its resulting humiliation of permanent subjugation in their own homeland. Edward addresses this challenge of apparent defeat and accompanying feelings of hopelessness, both in literature and in the relation to the Palestinian situation, and gives a very different answer than that of the cynical realist. In effect, he turns away from this prevalent kind of worldly realism as irrelevant and affirms that the only true choice is between surrender and resistance. He chooses resistance, or put differently, declares a refusal to accept the unacceptable, however unfavorable had become the facts on the ground. In so doing, Edward inverts this sinister Israeli formula frequently invoked. It is used to obtain a grudging acceptance by Washington of these de facto realities that are the result of trampling upon Palestinian rights under international law. So to appreciate Edwards' rejection of Oslo as a framework for peace, it is necessary to consider what was wrong about it from a Palestinian viewpoint. I would point to five features. First of all, the fragmentation of the West Bank into areas A, B, and C, making untenable territorial coherence during the period of occupation. Secondly, the idea that Palestinian goals may be achieved on the basis of Israeli consent, despite already in 1967, the United Nations Security Council unanimously mandated a withdrawal from the territory occupied during the 1967 war. Thirdly, the designation of the United States as the permanent intermediary for these negotiations, despite its partisan alignment with Israel, which already was in the driver's seat from a diplomatic perspective. And fourth, and maybe most important of all, the exclusion of international law and the authority of the United Nations from the negotiating process, which was the Palestinian trump in their political deck of cards. International law was clearly on the side of Palestinians in relation to their main claims and grievances. This included borders, refugees, settlements, Jerusalem, and water, as well as the day-to-day practices associated with the occupation itself. Without the inclusion of Palestinian rights under international law, diplomacy degenerates into a bargaining process, which ensures that power disparities will be embodied in any negotiated solution, and a heavily slanted, one-sided outcome in Israel's favor would be falsely proclaimed as peace. Even Palestinian objections to continuing Israeli settlement expansion as unlawful were rebuffed by Washington as unhelpful obstructions to the supposed peace process. The Palestinian humiliation was most vividly expressed by their acceptance of the 1993 Declaration of Principles that did not even refer to the Palestinian inalienable right of self-determination. Fifth and finally, the perverse deepening of such an exclusion by acquiescing in Israel's unlawful activities as being validated outside the negotiating framework. For instance, by George W. Bush's letter to Ariel Sharon in April 2004 to the effect that the U.S. government agrees that any end of the conflict must include the incorporation of the settlement blocks into Israel's territory. Hillary Clinton, while Obama's Secretary of State, added to this hegemonic sanitation of illegality, calling the settlement phenomenon, quote unquote, subsequent developments that must be acknowledged by the Palestinians if they genuinely sought peace. The unreasonableness of the deconstructed Oslo approach as a means to achieve a just peace is accentuated, in my view, by the prior unheralded forthcomingness of the PLO in its earlier endorsement of the 1988 Palestinian National Council decision to recognize Israel within its 67 borders. Such a bold unilateral initiative, supported by Edward when announced, in effect gave up the PLO's earlier refusal to accept the existence of Israel in any form, and it exhibited a willingness to swallow a territorial arrangement that accorded the Palestinians only 22% of historic Palestine. As is well known, this was less than half of what the UN in the partition plan of 1947 had offered, which at the time seemed grossly unfair given the relative size of the Jewish and Palestinian populations. The fact that such a unilateral diplomatic initiative by the Palestinians failed to yield any acknowledgement at all from Israel, much less some sort of reciprocal gesture, raises deep doubts as to whether, even then, when a far more moderate leadership existed in Tel Aviv, was there any real Israeli interest in achieving a two-state solution? This seems accurate despite the verbal assurances to the contrary over the years, including by Netanyahu, while at the same time taking a variety of steps that make the possibility of a Palestinian viable sovereign state less and less attractive to the Palestinians. These elements of the overall situation are descriptive of the defeatist period of the Palestinian intergovernmental posture that seemed ready to settle for arrangements that disregarded Palestinian rights under international law. There was considerable anxiety among Palestinian intellectuals around the Clinton initiative in 2000 that Arafat might make a deal that accepted the settlements and relinquished the rights of several million Palestinian refugees. In fact, the Second Intifada was interpreted at the time as a warning, as much a warning to the PLO as it was a rebuff of Israel. There were further disquieting developments in this period: massive settlement expansion, a refusal by Israel to respect the 2004 World Court findings calling for the dismantling of the separation wall, an apartheid structure of occupation in the West Bank, a process of incremental ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, and a harsh regime of collective punishment imposed on Gaza that featured three Israeli campaigns of state terror against a caged population in the course of the last 6 years. These attacks on Gaza, of warlike ferocity, that were unprecedented in locking the civilian population into the combat zone, disallowing even women and children to claim refugee status by crossing the border or seeking secure sanctuary within Gaza. Yet these dispiriting realities are far from the whole story of Palestinian resistance and struggle. The formal leadership of Palestine may have taken the defeatist route, but Palestinians as a people, by and large, kept their faith in the necessity of resistance and of not giving up their long quest for a sustainable and just peace. We need to remember that Edwards rejected the defeatist interpretation of the Palestinian lost cause, and in the process transferred his energies from the bankruptcy of top-down diplomacy to the empowering potential of bottom-up, people-oriented civil society militancy. This shift can be situated most dramatically in 1987, the time of the First Intifada, a mobilization of Palestinian resistance that was nonviolent, yet withheld all cooperation from the occupier. It was reinforced by the Second Intifada in 2000, that was again, in part, a populist reaction to Israeli policies, but lacked the nonviolent discipline of the earlier uprising. In 2005, a joint appeal from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations to launch a global boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign with its own defined political goals was a step toward resituating the national Palestinian movement. It represented a further shift in the direction of civil society leadership and toward a movement of global solidarity that has been gaining momentum in the last couple of years. This momentum was further accelerated by the moral outrage generated by the Israeli 50-day attack on Gaza that commenced in July of this year, which seemed especially, this reaction seemed especially strong in Western Europe. What seemed a defining moment in 1993 has now been superseded by a recent cluster of events defining a new defining moment in 2014, which involves a reformulation of perceptions in relation to the Palestinian struggle. In some ways, the situation from the Palestinian perspective has never seemed darker, undoubtedly making the cynical realist write off the conflict in even more strident language. The direct talks between Israel and the Palestinians have collapsed, and the lack of commitment by the Netanyahu government has been made explicit. The Israeli Knesset recently elected Reuven Rivlin as its 10th, as the 10th president of Israel, and he is, for the first time in such a high position, an outspoken advocate of incorporating the whole of the West Bank into Israel, along with Jerusalem, and implementing an Israeli one-state solution that fulfills the maximalist version of the Zionist project. Rivlin, unlike Netanyahu, believes that the oppression of the Palestinians should be eased, provided that they agree to live in law-abiding peace within a Jewish state that would once and for all extinguish Palestinian political dreams. Distressingly, also, the Arab countries in this recent conflict actually sided with Israel because of their own priorities directed at defeating grassroots Islamically oriented political movements in the region. And then Israeli public opinion, according to the Israeli peace activist and political figure Yuri Avneri, was 99% behind the fury of the attacks. Others noted high-level and populist incitement to genocide during the conduct of Operation Protective Edge. Once more, Gaza was devastated by attacks that killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, injured another 11,000, and traumatized the entire population, which was, as I suggested, locked into the combat zone with no means of escape. And the US Congress remains as unconditionally committed to Israel as ever. And to express its defiance of public opinion, Israel announced very dramatic settlement expansions that included the seizure of 1,000 acres of strategically located land between southern Jerusalem and Bethlehem, bisecting any prospective possible Palestinian state, and added 26 housing units to its approved list of what settlements could do to expand. This pattern of developments reveals an Israel facing little diplomatic pressure to resolve the conflict by negotiations and no incentive on its own to do so. For Palestine, there exists only a fragile unity between the PLO and Hamas and a debilitating dependence on Israel and the United States for the funds needed to maintain order in the territories under their administrative control. Yet in the face of this, one of the most brilliant Palestinian analysts of the conflict, Ali Abu Nima, writes these startling sentences at the very beginning of his fine new book, The Struggle for Justice in Palestine, and I quote, "The Palestinians are winning. This might seem like hubris or even insensitivity. After all, in so many ways, things have never looked worse. We must ask, what does Abu Nima mean by winning, and what basis can he have for being hopeful while being keenly aware of the dire situation facing the Palestinians?" Abu Nima is in effect telling my French diplomat to look deeper at the overall picture if he wants to understand the true reality of the situation. It is not a matter of how long you look that matters, but what you see. And what should we see? There are a few factors to consider. The discrediting of Oslo, the growth of the global solidarity movement, the moves toward Palestinian political unity, the recognition of Israeli criminality and American complicity as increasing pressures on the Palestinian Authority to take their complaints to the International Criminal Court, and growing evidence that Israel is more worried about what it calls the delegitimation project then about the threats posed by Palestinian armed resistance. And finally, the upsurge of regional extremism in the Middle East that could at some point undermine Israel's security. What Abu Nima sees that the realist, unblinkered vision misses are the legitimacy and psychopolitical dimensions of conflict that are so crucial in our post-colonial world. These dimensions center on the powerful mobilizing impact on a population of a denial of its inalienable right of self-determination and other elemental rights. This is particularly so, as in the Palestinian case, if the denial rests on colonialist patterns of occupation that are partially sustained by links to geopolitical actors, in this instance, the United States. Such a denial of rights creates a deep awareness of illegitimacy that is further heightened by Israel's defiance of international law, UN authority, and universal standards of morality. It strengthens the political will of Palestinians to engage in resistance and creates a climate that encourages more militant forms of global solidarity. This interplay of national resistance and a supportive global public opinion manifested by various kinds of activism is what turned the tide against European colonialism throughout the world. So far, the Zionist movement, aided by a unique set of historical circumstances, has succeeded in swimming against this nationalist tide in the global South. It should be observed that this historical trend should not be confused with the struggles of national self-determination against native autocracies. Chechnya, Tibet, and the regimes that have emerged in the Middle East after the Arab Spring do not support the rose-tinted view that democracy, human rights, and economic well-being are part of the anti-colonial narrative as to the flow of history. Furthermore, these victories over European colonialism neither produced benign national governments from the perspective of human rights, democracy, and social justice, nor did these nationalist victories neutralize the economic, diplomatic, and cultural roles of global hegemonic forces led by the United States in many national contexts. Let me end with two clusters of conclusions. The Palestinian struggle remains a lost cause in the French sense so long as the Oslo approach of reducing Palestinian representation to moderate forces, excluding Hamas, and endowing the United States with the role of impartial mediator constitutes the peace process. As welcome as were the Swedish and House of Commons initiatives on Palestinian statehood, they were ambiguous to the extent that they justified their initiatives as support for moderate Palestinians that could, it was believed, revive direct negotiation leading to a two-state solution. In effect, the message being sent is Oslo is dead, long live Oslo. These so-called moderates in Ramallah have proved themselves incapable of producing a sustainable and just peace. And if this is to happen, it must reflect the will of the Palestinian people and not their unrepresentative leaders. And it must not remain locked within a two-state mantra that has been made irrelevant by the passage of time. The second conclusion, the Palestinian struggle is more than ever a lost cause in the uplifting Edward Said sense of being centered on a commitment to Palestinian self-determination achieved by Palestinian resistance reinforced by a global solidarity movement. This Palestinian resistance in its latest phase has gained momentum primarily through nonviolent tactics of increasing militancy, and by rejecting the defeatist notion that the moderate voice of the Palestinian Authority can speak for the Palestinian people as a whole. This Palestinian public consensus also, by and large, rejects the view that Hamas speaks for the Palestinian people. Despite Hamas's recent popularity, even its in secular circles, due to their resilience and resistance in the face of Israel's recent campaign. This second commitment to the Palestinian lost cause is politically premised on the realization that people throughout the world have demonstrated historical agency in relation to the right of self-determination, and especially in reaction to European colonialism. Such a resolve also includes accepting what Edward so often stressed, that achieving Palestinian rights should never be realized through a second disposition, this time dispossessing the Jewish presence in historic Palestine. In effect, this presupposes a Palestinian acceptance of the core Zionist idea of a Jewish homeland, while rejecting both the notion of a Jewish state and the maximalist Zionist view currently being implemented that such a state should include the whole of historic Palestine, including the West Bank and Jerusalem. It is a hopeful sign that the Palestinian civil society consensus is also explicit in accepting a permanent Jewish presence in historic Palestine under these terms. Let me end with a reaffirmation of the complex relationship between our limited knowledge, especially of the future, and our political and moral will that has the irreducible freedom to create its own horizons. It is for this reason alone that it seems empowering to join with Edward Said and Zizek in declaring that our defense of lost causes, in this instance that of the Palestinian people, who have endured an unspeakable ordeal of victimization for so long, as in South Africa, where in the end, the racist white elites were able to remain after the collapse of the apartheid regime, it will take a comparable political miracle to reach a just and sustainable peace in Palestine that upholds the equal dignity of both peoples. In this spirit, I end with the enigmatic plea of the poet W.H. Auden, "We who are about to die demand a miracle." Thank you very much.
Professor Falk would like to sit down while he takes questions. He would be happy to take questions. I just have one request of you. Identify yourselves and as a courtesy, could you make your question a question? If you have a speech to make, you can go out in the street and make a speech, but questions would be welcome. So, who would like to ask a question? Sir. Richard. If you could stand up so we can hear you, please. There's a microphone.
And this one.
There was no mention of Hezbollah in your talk, Professor Falk. Is there any reason for that?
Did everybody hear the question, no mention of Hezbollah? I thought I mentioned too many things in my talk, but Hezbollah is, of course, relevant to the broader picture of the conflict, but it doesn't bear really on the perspective that I was trying to develop, which was the sense of how to interpret the Palestinian struggle at this stage of history, at this time, in view of what seems like a pattern of
defeat and weakness, and yet, in my view, is deceptive, because underneath what has been lost is the power of people determined to free themselves from a structure of domination and exploitation. And it was that I was trying to discuss by reference to this very suggestive and deep essay that Edward wrote toward the end of his life. That was my, I don't know if I communicated that effectively, but that was my intention, was that perspective which confronts this cynical realism that looks to military power as the primary agency of history. And I was trying to suggest if you look more carefully at the way conflicts have been resolved since 1945, very few have resulted in victories by the militarily superior side. If one limits the focus to conflicts involving struggles by oppressed peoples against foreign domination, and particularly Western colonial forms of domination, or military intervention to perpetuate those structures of domination.
Another question, maybe from a student. Is that Maui? Well, you may not be a student, but please go ahead.
We're
all students. You stand up and wait for the microphone, please.
Thank you, Zahra Arat, University of Connecticut. Thank you for another insightful, thought-provoking speech. My question is about where to focus in terms of our efforts. We tend to think about it always in terms of Palestine versus Israel, but the key player here is the United States, who has never been an impartial mediator. How can we make things turn around and influence the United States to take a different, perhaps maybe what we can say is like a balanced or impartial mediator position?
Thank you, Zahra, for the question, which is, of course, a very fundamental one for those of us who are here in America. I think one, at least in the immediate period, has to more or less ignore Washington and focus on this civil society activism, which seems to me to be generating the kind of legitimacy that has led other difficult political struggles to succeed, and to create some kind of climate that leads the Israeli leadership to recalculate their own interests, their own security. It's not going to happen in the context of intergovernmental diplomacy. One can maybe loosen the relationship slightly, as President Obama has at times seemed to try to do, but it doesn't affect the fundamental dynamics. The only thing that I think will affect it, and Israeli think tanks have sort of confirmed this by saying that the biggest threat to Israel comes from this delegitimation project. And what they mean by that is that when the pattern of commitment in the wider domains of public militancy reaches a certain threshold, it changes the balance of forces in a conflict. And those balance of forces cannot be calculated in hard power currency.
We're living in a world where a lot of the behavior that shapes the outcome of conflicts really results from gaining command of the soft power instruments of change.
Yes, in the front. Wait for the mic if you would. It's coming right up. Just a second. As soon as we can get it back.
Orange Rinkus, ex-Columbia, ex-United Nations. If somebody tells you this land is ours because God gave it to us, how do you get God to the negotiating table?
I wouldn't try. No, of course, the whole difficulty with religiously grounded politics is that it is not susceptible to any kind of reasoned negotiation. And to the extent that Israeli society has increasingly subscribed to this religious and quasi-religious foundation of their maximalist claims, there's very little prospect that that will change. There's been just released a poll conducted by the Jerusalem Center of Public Affairs that shows that more than 75% of Israelis oppose any return to the 1967 borders, that they oppose any division of Jerusalem, and that they oppose any withdrawal of the IDF forces from the Jordan Valley. If you put those three conditions together, it makes this call for resumed negotiations either something that is a sinister deception or the ravings of people out of touch with the realities. Maybe a little of both.
Wait for the microphone, please.
I have. It's interesting. When I read that this morning, I had the fantasy that the Israelis wanted a binational democratic state for all. I didn't even see it in the more negative light. What I wanted to ask you is, I was the only American on the Jewish boat to Gaza, so I have a little bit of something to say here, which never got there. What I dream of a binational state, a self-determined, really democratic state. But my question is about what to do with Zionism, and is there any way that Zionism can be changed into another form? Does anyone have any thoughts about that?
It's an interesting question. I'm probably not the best person to try to respond to it. I did try to suggest that the initial Zionist vision of a Jewish homeland is compatible with some kind of just and sustainable peace. What transformed that initial it was a colonially endorsed conception, but at least in the present world situation, where, as Edward suggested, and I agree with, whatever the injustices of the past, they had not to be resolved by dispossessing the people living in Israel at the present time. At the same time, the idea that 1.5 million Palestinians within 1967 Israel should accept a Jewish state as distinct from a Jewish homeland is, to me, unreasonable and incompatible with a contemporary notion of human dignity and human rights. And another thing that I think Edward stood for that is so remains so critical is the equality of the two peoples. When you read the discourse on security that bears on what kind of solution would be acceptable, there's always a focus on how to make Israel secure, as if Palestinian security is completely irrelevant. There's no consideration that the Palestinians have lived under the cruelty of pure vulnerability for over 60 years. And yet when the vision of peace is projected, it's Israel's security that alone is the subject of protection. And if there was a genuine motivation to achieve peace, both people's security would be considered as something that needed to be sustained.
I see a student back there. Gentleman in red. This will unfortunately have to be the last question. I'm sorry. Just been told that that's it.
Thank you. I'm Doron from Columbia Law School. I wanted to know if you think that Hamas's actions and statements during the last operation in Gaza promotes the Palestinian agenda or goals as you specified them, and if so, how?
What statements are you referring to?
Every statement that they have against the Israeli occupation, against the Zionist ruling of Israel, against all their agenda.
Well, the presentation of Hamas and what it stands for is a complex issue that hasn't been very intelligently depicted in this country and by the mainstream media. Hamas is a organization that has its own evolution, its own political evolution. And it is certainly the case that its covenant is a bloodthirsty document that certainly doesn't advance any prospect of reconciliation. But its own evolution, including becoming a political actor with the encouragement at the time of Washington to engage in competitive elections back in 2006, I think represented a deep choice by the Hamas leadership that they wanted to pursue the future through a nonviolent political process. That was their, and they sent, which is probably not very widely known, they sent a message to Bush as soon as they were elected saying, we don't want violence to be part of the future. We are ready to agree to a long-term plan of peaceful coexistence up to 50 years. And I've had conversations with both Michelle and Marzouk, two of the primary leaders of Hamas, both of whom have rather convincingly expressed their sense that they have no idea of liberating Palestine by armed struggle, and that they are ready for a political process of a long-term nature. And it is Israel that hasn't allowed them to escape from this terrorist box, because it serves their purposes of maintaining a kind of enemy that can be characterized as terrorist and therefore can be attacked at free will with no constraints. If we really seek peace and justice for both peoples,
we will reconsider what Hamas represents and how properly to approach their role in a future Palestine. Just one more remark about this. I was at an off-the-record talk by John Major, the former Prime Minister of Britain, who talked about the conflict in Northern Ireland while he was Prime Minister, and said he only made progress in resolving that conflict when he stopped thinking of the IRA as a terrorist organization and began to realize that they were a political actor with grievances and claims. And if we want peace, and this includes Iran as well as Hamas and the narrower conflict, if we want peace, we have to learn to think politically and not engage in this stereotyping of our adversaries as unconditionally evil, while our friends are unconditionally good. Thank you.
Join me in thanking Professor Falk.